Welcome to today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Thursday, July 16th. I'm your reader, Wanda, and here's our first story. U.S. executes second man in a week. Lawyer said he had dementia. The United States on Thursday carried out its second federal execution this week, killing by lethal injection a Kansas man whose lawyers contended he had dementia and was unfit to be executed. Wesley Ira Perkey was put to death at the Federal Correctional Complex in Terre Haute, Indiana. Perkey was convicted of kidnapping and killing a 16-year-old girl, Jennifer Long, before dismembering, burning, and dumping her body in a septic pond. He also was convicted in a state court in Kansas after using a claw hammer to kill an 80-year-old woman who had polio. Perkey was strapped to a gurney like inside the execution chamber. A prison official removed a mask from Perkey's face and asked if he wanted to make a final statement. He leaned his head up slightly from the gurney and said, "I deeply regret the pain and suffering I caused to Jennifer's family. I am deeply sorry." He also expressed remorse for his own adult daughter's suffering his actions caused. "I deeply regret the pain I caused to my daughter, who I love so very much," he said. His last words were, "This sanitized murder really does not serve no purpose whatsoever. Thank you." As the lethal chemical was injected, Perkey took several deep breaths and blinked repeatedly, laying his head back down on the gurney. His time of death was 8:19 a.m. Eastern Time. His spiritual advisor was in the room wearing a face mask and a surgical mask and appeared to be praying, his gloved hands held together at the palms. The Supreme Court cleared the way for the execution to take place just hours before, ruling in a 5-4 decision, the four liberal judges dissenting, like they did for the first case earlier this week. Justice Sonia Sotomayor wrote that proceeding with Perkey's execution now, despite the grave questions and factual findings regarding his mental competency, cast a shroud of constitutional doubt over the most irrevocable of injuries. She was joined by Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Stephen Breyer, and Elena Kagan. It was the federal government's second execution after a 17-year hiatus. Another man, Daniel Lewis Lee, was put to death Tuesday after his 11th-hour legal bids failed. Both executions were delayed into the day after they were scheduled as legal wrangling continued late into the night and into the next morning. The Justice Department has been questioned for holding the executions in the middle of the worsening coronavirus pandemic, prompting lawsuits over fears those who traveled to the prison could also become infected. The decision to resume executions after nearly two decades was criticized as a dangerously political move in an election year, forcing an issue that is not high on the list of American priorities, considering that 11% unemployment rate and the pandemic. Perkey's lawyers had argued his condition had deteriorated so severely that he didn't understand why he was being executed. They said he was repeatedly sexually assaulted as a child and had been diagnosed with schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, and other mental health conditions. The issue of Perkey's mental health rose in the run-up to his 2003 trial, and when after the verdict, jurors had to decide whether he should be put to death in the killing of the 16-year-old girl in Kansas City, Missouri. Prosecutors said he raped and stabbed her, dismembered her with a chainsaw, burned her, and dumped her ashes 200 miles away in a septic pond in Kansas. Herkey was separately convicted and sentenced to life in the beating death of 80-year-old Mary Ruth Bales of Kansas City, Kansas. Herkey had a long history of childhood trauma, was sexually abused by family members and a Catholic priest, and was beaten by other family members, said Liz Vartkesian, a mitigation specialist who worked with Herkey's legal team and visited him dozens of times in the last 5 years. His case is replete with instances where he has expressed a deep remorse, she said in an interview earlier this month. But recently, Herkey's mental health had seriously deteriorated to the point he didn't have the stamina for long visits with his legal team and often forgot key facts and dates, she said. Correction officers had to help him write down a schedule to remember his visits with his lawyers, she said. He also had a long history of paranoia and delusions and believed the Justice Department was moving forward with his execution because of many complaints and lawsuits he brought in prison, even though most had failed. The Supreme Court also lifted a hold placed on other executions set for Friday and next month. Dustin Honkin, a drug kingpin from Iowa, convicted of killing 5 people in a scheme to silence former dealers, was scheduled for execution Friday. Walmart to require customers to wear masks at all its stores. Walmart will require customers to wear face covering at all of its namesakes and Sam's Club stores, making it the largest retailer to introduce such a policy that has otherwise proven difficult to enforce without state and federal requirement. The company said the policy will go into effect on Monday to allow time to inform stores and customers. The Bentonville, Arkansas-based company said that currently about 65% of its more than 5,000 stores and clubs are located in areas where there is already some form of government mandate on face covering. The retailer also said it will create the role of health ambassador at its Walmart stores and will station them near the entrance to remind customers without masks of its new requirement. These workers who will be wearing black polo shirts will receive special training to help make the process as smooth as possible for customers. Walmart joins a growing list of retailers that have instituted mask mandates throughout their chains. Best Buy, the nation's largest consumer of electronic retailer, announced Tuesday that it will have the mask mandate for its customers at all of its stores. Starbucks announced last week that customers who visit its company-owned cafe locations in the U.S. will be required to wear face coverings. Both policies were in effect Wednesday. The move comes as new COVID-19 cases are spiking in many states, particularly Arizona, California, Florida, and Texas. Retailers have been challenged with striking a balance between keeping shoppers safe while making them feel comfortable. Last week, the retail industry leader organization, which represents Walmart, Best Buy, and other major chains, publicized a letter it sent to state governors to mandate store customers to wear face coverings. It said the hodgepodge of rules around the country have created confusion for shoppers, and that has led to conflict between customers and workers trying to enforce store rules. The National Governors Association said last week that its members are discussing the letter and others like it from different retail groups. Social media is full of videos capturing clashes between those who are asked to wear masks and employees who are under orders to make sure people wear them. Council Bluffs is home to 2 Walmart stores, one on North 16th Street and one in the Lake Manawa Power Center and one Sam's Club in the Lake Manawa Power Center. Kudos to them for recognizing the importance of stopping the spread. Allison McGinn responded on Facebook when the nonpareil asked readers for their reaction. The sooner we all wear masks, the sooner we can crush this virus and get back to a more normal life. I wear one every time I go to the store. The sooner we can all get behind this, the sooner we can get this behind us. Michael Durham responded, I don't like wearing masks, but this isn't about me. It's about trying to help others and doing my part. Bull, responded Lisa Dilly Axtell, who later noted, and if they mandate it to everyone, they should supply them. Some readers said they would no longer shop at the stores, like Lawton Biddle called the move just a scare tactic. Many said they already wear a mask at the store and welcome the move. I support their decision and also understand many others won't, Cheryl Ross said. Great things about this country. You have the freedom to shop elsewhere if you don't like their policies. Fewer than half of the U.S. states require masks in public places, according to RILA, and only a handful of major retailers, including teen clothing chain American Eagle Outfitters, has a mask mandate for customers for all of its stores. Costco Wholesale Club was one of the first major retailers to require face coverings for customers at all of its stores. The policy went into effect in early May. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recommends people cover their mouths and nose when around other people to help reduce the spread of the virus that causes COVID-19. We know some people have differing opinions on this topic, wrote Dakona Smith, Chief Operating Officer at Walmart U.S., and Lance De La Rosa, Chief Operating Officer at Sam's Club, in a blog posted Wednesday. We also recognize the role we can play to help protect the health and well-being of the communities we serve by following the evolving guidance of health officials like the CDC. Ernst campaign raises $3.6 million fundraising haul. Iowa Republican Joni Ernst, U.S. Senate re-election campaign, reported Tuesday, raising $3.6 million during the most recent three-month federal fundraising period. Ernst campaign also reported finishing the period with more than $9.1 million in its campaign account, which it said was the largest publicly available cash on hand total of any Iowa candidate in recent history. Ernst has finished her first six-year term in the U.S. Senate. She faces Democratic challenger Teresa Greenfield in the November election. Team Joni is energized by the grassroots momentum that continues to build as Joni crisscrosses the state and visits with Iowans, Ernst campaign spokesman Brendan Conley said in a statement. Greenfield's campaign previously reported raising more than $6 million during the same period. All figures are according to the campaigns because neither has officially filed its fundraising report for the three-month reporting period, which covers April through June. The filing deadline was Wednesday. Stocks open lower on Wall Street. Twitter sinks after a hack. Stocks are opening broadly lower on Wall Street Thursday, extending weakness in overseas markets. The S&P 500 index gave up 0.6% in the early going, led by losses in technology companies. Twitter sank after a breach of its security allowed hackers to break into the accounts of technology moguls, politicians, and other major figures. Bank of America also fell after reporting that its profits were chopped in half in the latest quarter as the bank set aside billions of dollars to cover potentially bad loans caused by the coronavirus pandemic. Treasury yields fell after climbing the day before. Shares retreated in Europe and Asia on Thursday as investors sold on worries Beijing might cut back on stimulus after China's economy returned to growth in the last quarter. Shanghai Composite Index led Thursday deadline, chopping 4.5% to 3,200.1. Benchmarks also fell in Tokyo, Hong Kong, and Sydney. No news that China's economy grew 3.2% in annual terms in April to June after a 6.8% contraction in the previous quarter failed to keep an overnight rally going. Next article. Number of laid-off workers seeking jobless aid stuck at 1.3 million. The number of laid-off workers seeking unemployment benefits remains stuck at 1.3 million last week, a historically high level that indicates many companies are still cutting jobs as the viral outbreak intensifies. The elevated levels of applications for jobless aid is occurring as new confirmed cases of coronavirus are spiking across much of the Sun Belt, threatening to weaken the economic recovery. Case counts are rising in 40 states, and 22 states have either paused or reversed their efforts to reopen their economies, according to Bank of America. Rising infections paralleled rising applications for aid in some states getting hit right now, and fell in states with declining infections. In Florida, claims doubled to 129,000, and in Georgia, they rose nearly one-third to 136,000, according to Labor Department's Thursday report. In California, they increased 23,000 to nearly 288,000. Applications also rose in Arizona and South Carolina. Applications fell in Texas, which has seen infections spike, and in New Jersey and New York, where the virus is mostly under control. Conditions in the labor market remain weak, and the risk of mounting permanent job losses is high, especially if activity continues to be disrupted by repeated virus-related shutdowns, said Rubila Farocki, chief economist at High Frequency Economics. A separate government report showed that retail sales jumped 7.5% in June, a healthy gain that suggested the economy is healing, just before the viral resurgence has weighed on hopes for a steady recovery. The Census Bureau reported Thursday that retail sales are 1.1 higher than their levels from a year ago, after a brutal plunge in March and April was offset by a decent rebound in May and June. While applications for jobless aid fell by about 10,000 from the previous week, the figure has now topped 1 million for 17 straight weeks. The record high for weekly unemployment applications before the pandemic was nearly 700,000. Those figures are adjusted for seasonal variation, a practice intended to filter out trends that don't reflect on the economy, such as the firing of seasonal workers after the winter holidays. Yet, the impact of the coronavirus has made such adjustments less relevant, economists say, because claims are so far above normal levels. Before seasonal adjustment, applications rose 100,000 to 1.5 million, a sign that layoffs were worsening. The total number of people who are receiving jobless benefits dropped 400,000 to 17.3 million, the government said. That suggests that some companies are continuing to rehire workers, which could offset some of the job losses reflected in the still high level of claims. An additional 928,000 people sought benefits last week under a separate program for self-employed and gig workers that has made them eligible for aid for the first time. These figures aren't adjusted for seasonal variations, so the government doesn't include them in the official count. The economic recovery is also threatened by the pending expiration of many government support programs that have shored up household and business finances. The government's small business loan program, known as the Paycheck Protection Program, will finish taking applications August 8th. More than $500 billion has already been lent, and more than half of small companies that got loans say they have spent all the money, according to a survey by the National Federation of Independent Business. Nearly one quarter say they have or expect they will lay off workers once the funds run out. And an extra $600 a month unemployment benefits provided by the federal government on top of regular aid from the states is set to expire this month. Those funds, along with $1,200 relief checks sent out in April, enabled millions of Americans to stay current on housing costs and bills. Megan McGowan, 30, lost two jobs when the pandemic intensified in mid-March. One is a full-time librarian in Detroit, and the second as a substitute at a different library system to help bring in some extra cash. She currently is making more from unemployment than she earned at her previous jobs, but is prepared to return to work even though she worries about the health risks. Detroit is a viral hotspot. The looming expiration of the $600 is nerve-wracking for her because the hiatus on her student loans will end this fall, and she has an auto insurance bill due. Before, when I was working through grad school, I worked in restaurants, so that had always been my backup plan. But that's not an option now, she said. Companies continue to lay off people. American Airlines warned its workers Wednesday that it may have to cut out to 25,000 jobs in October because of sharply reduced air travel. Airlines are barred from layoffs until then as a condition of federal aid they have received. American Airlines has already told 36,000 workers they may lose their job. Air traffic began to slowly rebound in mid-April, but like other parts of the economy, the improvement plateau is in July as the virus outbreak worsens. 43% of Americans plan to delay retirement due to COVID-19. The coronavirus pandemic has already forced many Americans to put their plans on hold. A second wave of COVID-19 could seriously impact your future. Many older adults are being forced to rethink their retirement plans thanks to the pandemic, with 43% of Americans saying they plan to postpone and continue working past their planned retirement date, according to a survey from nonprofit organization Life Happens. Working longer could be a smart move that potentially saves you a lot of money during your senior years, but delaying retirement also poses major risks that you'll need to consider. Retiring right now could be a risky proposition because the number of COVID-19 infections has been skyrocketing across the country. Businesses could close their doors once more, which could affect the stock market. A second stock market crash could devastate your retirement savings, making it harder to enjoy your senior years comfortably. In addition, withholding your savings during a market turndown can be dangerous because you're selling your investments when stock prices are at rock bottom. That means you're essentially locking in your losses, and your savings may not last as long as you'd hoped. By delaying retirement, even a year or two, you'll not only have more time to save, but you can also avoid withdrawing your investments while the stock market is down. That could result in a larger nest egg by the time you're ready to retire. Working longer than expected isn't necessarily bad, but assuming you'll be able to delay retirement can be risky. Nearly 40% of current retirees say they retired earlier than they expected, according to a survey from the Aegon Center for Longevity and Retirement. Two of the top reasons for early retirement include job loss and health issues. While older adults are also vulnerable to job loss and health problems, the risk is even greater right now. If businesses close as a result of the second wave of COVID-19, another round of mass layoffs could be looming. As the number of coronavirus infections rises, it's more likely you could get sick by continuing to work, especially considering only 47% of workers age 65 and older have a job that can be performed remotely, according to a report from the Center for Retirement Research at Boston College. Banking on being able to work as long as you like, but then being forced into early retirement could negatively affect your savings. You won't have as much time to save for retirement, and you may need to make some serious financial sacrifices to make ends meet. Saving for the future is tough right now. You might have to work longer if your savings have taken a hit, and you'll simultaneously need to prepare for the possibility of retiring early, whether you want to or not. It's impossible to know exactly what the future holds, but do your best to save as much as you can right now. You may need to make some budget cuts to put more in your retirement fund, but that's better than holding off on saving and being forced to live on less if you retire early. Consider picking up a side gig or a source of passive income. It's not always easy to find these jobs, but adding another source of income can help significantly if you're laid off or unable to work due to health problems. COVID-19 may have thrown off your retirement plans, but that doesn't mean you can't still retire comfortably. Working longer can be a great way to save money and build a healthier nest egg. But make sure you've thought about the drawbacks. By understanding the risks and rewards of delaying retirement, you can make the best decision for your situation. You are listening to the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. I'm your reader, Wanda. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, give us a call at 515-243-6833. And now we'll turn to today's obituaries. These obituaries all say July 15th, but I don't know if they were read yesterday, so I will read them. Reverend Donald Edward Levenhagen, age 85, of Fremont, Nebraska, passed away April 24th, 2020. A celebration of life will be held Saturday, July 18th, 2020, at 11 a.m. at Trinity Lutheran Church in Fremont. Directed health measures will be followed, and masks are suggested. Please direct memorials to the Levenhagen family in care of Ludvigsen Mortuary, 1249 East 23rd Street, Fremont, Nebraska, 68025. The service will be live streamed at trinityfremont.com/live-service beginning at 11 a.m. Online guestbook at www.ludvigesenmortuary.com. Arlene Mae Rudolph Yeomans was born October 3, 1928, in Fremont, Nebraska, to George and Marion Ibsen Rudolph. She grew up on the farm with her sister, Vernell, and attended a Dodge County country school. Arlene graduated from Fremont High School in 1946. She attended Dana College in Blair, Nebraska, where she met her future husband, James A. H. Yeoman, Jr. James and Arlene were married on August 28, 1949, at Bluffs Trinity Lutheran Church in rural Dodge County. Arlene achieved her state teaching credentials in 1948 and taught school at Elkhorn, Nebraska, until her husband's graduation from Dana College in 1950. Her three children, Alan, Dale, and Luann, were all born in Blair. The family moved to Persia, Iowa in 1957, where Arlene later returned to teaching elementary school at Tri-Center Community Schools, completing her college degree from Dana College in 1968, and eventually retiring after 30 years of dedicated teaching. After the death of her husband in 2012, she moved to Omaha, Nebraska, to initially live with her loving daughter, Luann, later moving into the Rolling Hills Ranch Independent Living Facility in 2016. Arlene left Rolling Hills in May of 2020 to live alternatively with her daughter, Luann, and son, Alan, in the Phoenix, Arizona area. Arlene passed away on June 27, 2020, in Carefree, Arizona, gently supported by Zephyr Hospice Care. Arlene lived her strong Christian faith every day of her long life. During her life, she was an active member of Bluffs Trinity Lutheran Church, First Lutheran Church, Blair, St. John's Lutheran Church, Persia, Trinity Lutheran Church, Persia, and St. John's Lutheran Church, Bennington, Nebraska. Arlene taught Sunday school for many years and was active in the Ladies' Aid. She possessed a beautiful soprano voice and sang throughout her life in the Dana College a cappella choir, in her church choirs, at weddings and funerals, and at her Rolling Hills Ranch residence. Arlene was later active in her church quilting group. She made many quilts for her family, friends, and their pets. She devoted many years to the Iowa American Legion Auxiliary. Arlene was uniformly viewed as a kind, gentle, considerate person who willingly and humbly gave of herself to others. Anyone who knew Arlene invariably described her as one of the nicest people I ever met. Arlene was preceded in death by her devoted husband of 62 years, James, her loving parents, George and Marion Ibsen Rudolph, her beloved sister, Vernell Rudolph Ruff, a treasured brother-in-law, Lowell Ruff. Arlene is survived by her son, Alan, wife, Julene Yeomans, son, Dale, wife, Yvonne Yeomans, daughter Luann Lathrop, granddaughters Allison, husband Tanner Forster, Erica Lathrop, great-grandsons Hayes and Graham Forster, niece Gail, husband Steve Sampson, her special nephew Wayne, wife Karen Ruff, nephews Bruce, wife Tamara Ruff, three step-grandchildren, her five step-great-grandchildren, and many great-grandnephews, grandnieces, her great-great-grandnephews, and great-grandnieces. A good life, well lived. Funeral service 11 a.m. Friday, July 17th, 2020 at St. John's Lutheran Church, 322 North Moley Street, Bennington, Nebraska. A private interment at Valley View Cemetery in Persia later. Memorials may be directed to VNA Hospice of Omaha or St. John's Lutheran Church. Mary Ellen Hearns, Hearn, H-E-A-R-N, age 67 of Lakeville, Minnesota, formerly of Council Bluffs, passed away at St. Paul, Minnesota on June 17, 2020. A celebration of life services will be held at 11 a.m. Saturday, July 18, 2020, at the First Congregational Church. Luncheon will follow. Please, no flowers, donations to a charity of your church choice in memory of Mary. Condolences to the following address, www.whitefuneralhomes.com. Sports. St. Albert's tops trainer in Class 2A regional play. St. Albert's continued what's been a remarkable turnaround with a 5-4 win in 8 innings over Trainer on Wednesday in a Class 2A Region 1 quarterfinal. Eighth grader Alexis Narmi not only pitched her team to victory, but she also delivered a walk-in single in the bottom of the eighth inning, sending the Saints to the next round. She always has such great poise and control of her emotions as an eighth grader, and I'm always aware of it, St. Albert's head coach Lindsay Daly said. She got up there in the eighth, and I think she knew she was going to get a hit. After finishing with a record of 4-29 last season, Wednesday's doubled the Saints' win total from last year, which is even more impressive considering this year's abbreviated season. After Narmi's hit found green grass, the emotions from the St. Albert dugout was no surprise. Ecstatic, Daly said. The girls knew we could do this and know that we should have had even more than 8 wins this year. They believe that we're a pretty good team, and we talked about just taking one battle at a time. I'm just so proud of them. St. Albert's senior Shelby Hatcher had 3 RBIs, including a go-ahead RBI sack fly to put the Saints up 4-3 in the bottom of the 6th inning. But in a game that featured 8 ties and lead changes, Trainer's Tori Castle tied it at 4-4 with a RBI single in the top of the 7th. St. Albert threatened in the home half, getting the would-be game-winning run to third base with one out, but could not put one across. After Narmi and the Saints' defense blanked Trainer in the top of the 8th, Bella Dingus, who played for Trainer last season, led off with a walk for St. Albert. A Laney Sheffield sack bunt got the courtesy runner to second, followed by a Shelby Hatcher single. The runner attempted to score but was thrown out at home. Meanwhile, Hatcher scampered to second, setting up Narmi's game winner. St. Albert advances to play at West Monona 19-1 on Friday, which defeated AHSTW 6-1 on Wednesday. TJ falls at Harlan in final regular season game. Harlan's Brendan Bartley had a pair of hits and 4 RBIs, and Joey Mosier added 3 hits and 3 RBIs as Harlan earned a 9-7 non-conference victory Wednesday over Thomas Jefferson. TJ's Tyler Huey had a pair of RBIs, and Ryan Steinspring had 2 runs and a hit in the losing effort. TJ will return to action Friday to take on Des Moines North in the opening round of Class 4A Substate, and Harlan will play host to Creston the same night in Class 3A District play. Neola residents give Fire Chief royal send-off by Tim Johnson. Neola residents gave their fire chief a royal send-off Saturday. Neola Fire and Rescue Chief Greg Hine is leaving to run his family's farm near Waco, Nebraska, about 120 miles west of Neola, he said. I'm going back to where I grew up, he said. Hine's parents are slowing down and have moved out of the house on the farm, he said. He expects to shoulder a lot of the work of raising corn and soybeans on the 850-acre farm. He has also lined up a job with the York County, Nebraska Roads Department. Hine has been with the fire chief in Neola for about a year and has served on the volunteer department for almost 20 years. On Saturday, Bud Johansson, one of his 22 comrades in battling fires, presented him with a custom wood panel on behalf of the department for his leadership, dedication, and 20 years of service. He's been through several changes of leadership, and it's all volunteer, so it's pretty unusual that someone sticks around with it that long, Johansson said. An 8 to 10 year veteran of the department who hosted the farewell party. Absolutely, hands down, he's one of the greatest firemen around, one of the greatest people around, he said. He's an all-round great person. Hine has also helped with the community annual Hoodoo Days, youth sports, and other activities. He usually takes the day off all or part of Friday before Labor Day weekend to help us set up, said Bobby Munch, a longtime member of the Hoodoo Days committee. Hine would help set up tables, set up the beer garden, and set up the parade route, Munch said. He helps the city guys with anything they need for Hoodoo Days, she said. He leads the fire wars, helps with the parade. He helps get the fire trucks lined up properly. All around, he's just a great guy who helps anyone who needs it at any time, Munch said. Hine moved to Neola in 2001 when he worked hauling propane for what is now Heartland Co-op. In about 2010, he got a job working for the Roads Department of the Iowa Department of Transportation. Both jobs have been really good with letting me go to fire calls when I needed to, he said. Hine and his wife, Tricia, have twin 9-year-old sons, Garrett and Dylan. The twins have played youth soccer, and their dad has served as an assistant coach. They're both really excited about being on the farm, he said. One's into electronics and the other's into tractors. Tricia works in a laboratory at Methodist Jenny Edmondson Hospital and previously worked at CHI Health Lab in Omaha. She grew up in Neola, where her parents still live. Hines also has an older son, Spencer, who graduated this year from Tri-Center Community Schools. Spencer was active in baseball, band, and football, and Hines coached baseball for the 6 seasons while Spencer was playing. Spencer plans to attend Iowa Western Community College this fall on a Potawatomi Promise scholarship and study robotics. Council Bluffs Chamber, Others Team Up on Watershed Study by Mike Brownlee. The Council Bluffs Area Chamber of Commerce is teaming with a pair of state agencies to take a look at the needs of the area labor market. Iowa Workforce Development, along with the Chamber of Commerce and the Iowa Economic Development Authority, is leading a labor shed study to geographically define which communities contribute to Council Bluffs' workforce, regardless of governmental boundaries, according to the Chamber. That geographic area constitutes a labor shed. if you look at all the people who work in the Council Bluffs area, how far do they commute? What are those trends? Said Lori Shields, Vice President of Communications and Leadership Development for the Chamber. In a release, the Chamber said the purpose of the study is to measure the availability and characteristics of Council Bluffs area workers, adding that labor shed studies are useful tools for economic development teams and existing or prospective employers to understand the local labor market, make informed expansion and site selection decisions, and maintain, recruit a high quality workforce. The information from this study helps to attract businesses. They'll have a better understanding of what the workforce in our community looks like, Shields said. Chamber Interim Director Tom Hannafin noted the benefits for existing businesses as well. He said businesses often come to the chamber with needs. We had a business come to us, said they wanted to grow. They needed 50 electricians. How do you get that employee base? He said, the idea is to build a good quality workforce. On that end, Hannafin credits Iowa Western Community College and local schools for skilled trade programs that are preparing students for the future. We're in the process of bringing in a full-time labor workforce development people, Hannafin said to the chamber. The Labor Shed study partners are sending letters to randomly selected households asking residents to take a confidential online survey, the release said. Survey questions will cover topics including employment status, current and desired wages, current and desired benefits, education level, and types of occupations, among other questions. The release noted Iowa Workforce Development will not be asking survey takers identifiable information such as name, Social Security number, or date of birth. Participants in this workforce study is greatly appreciated regardless of employment status, whether you are currently employed, unemployed, a homemaker, retired, etc. Your input is highly valued, the study partner said in the release. Every year, Iowa Workforce Development conducts labor shed studies across the states. The results of each analysis are publicly available online at potawatomi.gov/labor-shed. For more information on the Labor Shed project, contact Katie Lippold, Lippold, with Iowa Workforce Development at 515-281-3035 or the Council Bluffs Area Chamber of Commerce at 712-325-1000. County reports 7 new cases of COVID-19. Pottawatomie County reported 7 new cases of COVID-19 Wednesday around 3 p.m. CoronavirusIowa.gov listed 849 positive cases, up from 842 cases roughly 24 hours before. There have been 11,445 tests in the county for a positive rate of 7.4%. There have been 13 deaths, and the county lists 681 recoveries. Crawford and Cass counties each listed one fewer case than reported at last check of the numbers by the Nonpareil. Iowa Department of Public Health and other public health officials have said numbers are sometimes corrected if test result reports are duplicated. The state COVID-19 website updates frequently throughout the day. Here's a look at numbers in Southwest Iowa, based on data from the counties and the state website. Pottawatomie County, 849 cases, 681 recoveries, 11,445 tests, 7.4% of those have come back positive, 13 deaths. Mills County, 53 cases, 32 recoveries, 2,161 tests, 2.5%. Harrison County, 63 tests, cases, 48 recoveries, 1,230 tests, 5.1%. Cass County, 29 cases, 24 recoveries, 995 tests, 2.9%. Shelby County, 121 cases, 113 recoveries, 1,218 tests, 9.9%. Montgomery County, 16 cases, 10 recoveries, 911 tests, 1.1%, 2 deaths. Monona County, 78 cases, 62 recoveries, 990 tests, 7.9%. Crawford County, 641 recoveries, 3,163 tests, 21.5%, 3 deaths. Page County, 22 cases, 20 recoveries, 1,349 tests, 1.6%. Fremont County, 11 cases, 6 recoveries, 471 tests, 2.3%. Judge denies request to delay drug kingpin's execution. The federal judge has denied an Iowan drug kingpin's request to delay his execution, which is scheduled for Friday. U.S. District Judge Leonard Strand wrote Tuesday that he would not intervene to delay Dustin Honkin's execution due to the coronavirus pandemic. He said the Bureau of Prisons was in the best position to weigh the health risk against the benefits of carrying out the execution. Strand also denied Honkin's motion to declare his execution void due to the alleged procedural error by the government. He affirmed the executive branch's power to set the date for execution. Honkin's, 52, is scheduled to die by lethal injection at the federal prison in Terre Haute, Indiana. The government executed a federal inmate Tuesday for the first time in 17 years. A second execution was scheduled for Wednesday. Honkin is facing execution for the 1993 slaying of 5 people in the Mason City area. Prosecutors says Honkin killed them in an attempt to thwart an investigation into his methamphetamine trafficking business. Also Tuesday, a federal judge in Indiana denied a request by Honkin's spiritual advisor to put the execution on hold. The advisor, a Catholic priest, had asked to delay the execution until after the pandemic recedes. Iowa's C.J. Frederick has surgery for stress fracture in foot. Iowa guard C.J. Frederick is expected to be ready for preseason practice after having surgery on his right foot, the school announced Wednesday. Frederick on Tuesday had a screw inserted in his fifth metatarsal, the long bone on the outside of the foot that connects to the little toe, to alleviate a stress fracture. He is expected to recover within 6 weeks. The timing for this surgery was perfect, Frederick said. The procedure will allow me to recover quickly and be able to play pain-free in that foot for the season. I can't wait to begin rehabbing and working toward the upcoming season. Frederick started all 25 games as a freshman last season. He led the Big Ten in three-point percentage, 0.461, and averaged 10.2 points per game. Frederick was the only player from a major conference since 1993 with at least 65 assists, 32 or fewer turnovers, and a 46 or better shooting from three-point range. CJ's right foot has been bothering him for several weeks, and this procedure is a proactive approach to expedite the healing process, Coach Fran McCaffrey said. CJ has had a tremendous off-season training, and we are confident he will be even stronger when he returns next month. That brings us to the end of today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil. I'm your reader, Wanda. Thanks for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.